Hello, I'm Dr. David Johnson, Professor of Medicine and Chief of Gastroenterology at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia. The term medical malpractice will bring a chill down everybody's spine, unless you're, of course, you're a trial prosecution lawyer, and then perhaps that makes your day. But nonetheless, good doctors get sued. Unfortunately, some of these good doctors are actually found guilty. Now, what can we do to prevent medical malpractice? A fantastic contribution has just been made by Dr. Doug Rex from Indiana University, where he has outlined his experience in dealing as a defense and rarely as a plaintiff expert in the field of colon cancer and colonoscopy-related malpractice allegations. Doug's gone through a very programmatic way of lessons learned as he's looked at a number of cases over the years and points out for us what can be done to optimize your chances of, number one, not having an effective suit, and if a suit is brought, how to successfully defend it. Well, it starts with the informed consent, and the points to be made are informed consent needs to be broadened beyond just colonoscopy and perforation. That should be, that the word should be in that every time a description of preparation is made for informed consent, that perforation, specific word, resulting in a need for surgery should be in the informed consent. But Doug goes on beyond that, and there are a couple of things that really need to be included. Aspiration is one potential, and this should be mentioned. Phlebotomy, or the phlebitis, in particular if you're still using Demerol and some of the phlebitic type medications, the benzodiazepines, may be more irritant. That's a minor thing, but we add it into our consent as well. One that is potentially missed by most people is the opportunity to miss a significant lesion, and this must be in your informed consent. The way that Doug does this and the way we do it in our practice is basically say colonoscopy is the best test, but no test recognizably is perfect, and all we can do is do the best we can, and I'm an expert in this field and I'm going to do that for you today, but recognize unfortunately no test is perfect. There are always rare risks of things being missed. This is the best test. The other area that is not routinely included in informed consent, and Doug makes a point in this particular malpractice discussion, and also a very excellent Thinking Out of the Box article that he just published in the June issue of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, and that focuses on mentioning splenic trauma and splenic bleed and splenic injury. This is usually thought to be more of a case report type thing, but the incidence of splenic trauma may be more in the range of 1 in 6,000. It seems to be that as you get into the area of the spleen and beyond the spleen, an emphasis of torquing in particular once you get past the spleen may put increased stress on the splenocolic ligaments and thereby increase the likelihood for potential bleeding. Doug's got an excellent picture in GIE, and I'll reference this gastrointestinal endoscopy article along with this dialogue today. But look at that picture. It shows free blood along the submucosa, and you can see this along the left colon, something to look for on the way out. But splenic-related trauma should be something probably to be included in informed consent based on what we see, and we really don't know the emphasis of what the prevalence of this really truly is. The next area is bowel prep, and I will begin by saying that the standard of care is a split dose, and Doug goes into this in a fairly formative way, saying if you're not doing a split dose, you do increase the likelihood for a bad prep, thereby the likelihood for not having an optimal exclusion of even small lesions or potentially even large lesions. This is your problem. If you're not using the standard of care, then the defense or the prosecution lawyer can say, well, don't you know what the literature says? And you must have understood that this would be suboptimal prep, and therefore this is suboptimal technique, and therefore you probably missed something. Isn't that correct, doctor? So I think you have no leg to stand on, and Doug makes this point, if you're not using split prep, the only exception to that rule would be if you use a same-day prep for late afternoon colonoscopy, and I think this the data is comparable there, but you must be using a split dose prep, and that's to enhance your detection, and your adenoma detection rate goes up along with that line. It is important to know what your adenoma detection rate is. Why is that? Well, we do know that that increases the likelihood for you being a good quality colonoscopist, but if you don't know and somebody then says, well, what's your adenoma detection rate, there's a missed cancer, you again become immediately as a substandard low-quality colonoscopist, and hence the burden of proof is more on you to prove that you didn't miss something. Whereas if you know what your adenoma detection rate is, you can say I'm X, and therefore I am a quality colonoscopist. Now, Doug makes the point, do you mention that in your informed consent? And he does not, nor do I. If asked, I would certainly volunteer that. There are a number of patients that actually will ask you that because they're fairly savvy on the internet and such. But I wouldn't bring that up as a proactive point. But you must have that in your hip pocket when starting to defend a potential case. It's important, too, to make sure that you're beginning the exam with an adequate rectal exam. In particular, this is not just to lubricate the anus. So the full digital rectal exam and the full inspection of the anal canal and the above the dentate line with a circumferential sweep, very important to document that that was done. Again, in particular, when you start to put that in your note, make sure that that was explicitly a rectal exam was performed. Photodocumentation is another important part that Doug makes in this particular review, and it's important to note a couple things. One, we always want to document the adequacy of the prep, but it's the adequacy of the prep as defined when you are done with your cleaning. So you could easily say it was an inadequate prep on the way in, but it was debris and fecal material that could be lavaged and suction clear. And you want to show the picture thereby of the adequacy of the prep after your initiative efforts to clean up the area and potentially maximize the yield. So make sure that you do make some pictures looking at where your prep documentation is. You should always document that you're in the cecum. There typically are two, if not three, views that we use. One is above the ileocecal valve, looking into the area of the appendiceal orifice and showing the ileocecal valve. Two is distal to the ileocecal valve, adjacent to the appendiceal orifice. And in particular, here the emphasis is to show the lateral walls, in particular the area below the ileocecal valve, which I think frequently is missed in documentation. I routinely retroflex in the area of the cecum as well to look back up, and that's something that you can do. And again, make sure that that documentation is complete. The same for the rectum. It's very important to document the rectal. We routinely retroflex. If it's a tight, very fixed area, it may not be so easy to retroflex. So a view from the dentate line, looking in and circumferentially showing the distal rectum at the dentate line, is an acceptable alternative. How about withdrawal time? Doug goes into this as well. Withdrawal time is another indicator of potential quality colonoscopy, and recognize what is on the photo is frequently something that may come back to haunt you. If you document when you got to the cecum and your picture shows timestamp there, and then you document at your retroflexion, again a timestamp there, and you have a disparity here of minutes beyond what would be the standard 6 minute or more withdrawal, you do have a problem, at least potentially, in saying that this is a shortened colonoscopy. Again, recognize the 6 minute rule is for average. But again, if you have a missed cancer, you may have a potential real problem. One area that may enhance your withdrawal time is to take a second look at the colon in the right side. I make this point in particular if you have a polyp in the right side. If you see one polyp in the right side, do a second sweep. Make sure, because the incident rate in the second find of a polyp in the right colon is extremely high. Again, this will enhance your withdrawal times, and again, something that makes sense. Finally, as far as language, if you are dictating these reports as opposed to most of us using our EndoWriter, you want to standardize the language to show that you had maximized technique, optimizing all areas, effacing folds, in particular at the flexures, and gently withdraw using circumferential examination technique, retroflexion in the rectum, and again, documentation of areas that are specific for defining the endpoints of your procedure. This is something that I think, again, is a mandatory read for all of you doing colonoscopy, and it's particularly something that we all should thank Doug for putting this together, and the years of his experience will give us, hopefully, a lot of ways to avoid an experience going forward. Read the article, too, on splenic trauma, because I think this is something that, again, is very interesting. There's an excellent picture to show you the free blood sign in the left colon in June issue in Gastrointestinal Endoscopy. Hopefully these discussions will serve you well, keep you out of trouble, and again, I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks again for listening.